Welcome to the 20% True Podcast, Season 5, Monster of the Week, Episode 4, The Labyrinth. I'm Carolyn Rahaman. Tony and Joanna prepared. They'd heard about the horribleness of the labyrinth's dim lighting and curling pathways. They'd heard of people walking for so long, they lay down for a rest and woke up disoriented and lost. They'd heard that if you touched the stone walls, they were so cold your arm would go numb, hanging lifeless at your side, leaving you vulnerable. They'd heard that the labyrinth's offerings stretched for winding miles in an overwhelming selection with complicated variations. Joanna's old roommate, before Joanna moved in with Tony and then moved to a nicer apartment with Tony and then bought a condo with Tony, once went to the labyrinth and found a bland painting of a seaside to brighten the bare living room wall. After a month of trying to find the vanishing point, she'd become convinced that the painting was backwards. If only she could see it in reverse. Something would click into place and the oddness of the picture would make sense. She returned to the labyrinth for a mirror to hang on the opposite wall. Joanna prepared. From her research, she found that the offerings were documented online by a massive contingent of volunteers, and she went through the neatly organized listings of coffee tables with Tony's chin perched on her shoulder. Together, they found what they wanted. They agreed easily, because of course they did. They were in love. And the horror stories of the labyrinth drawing out aggression and disagreement like a leech were just stories. Or they were stories that only applied to couples with a lesser love, less trust and understanding. Tony prepared. He procured a map of the labyrinth from the same website that guided Joanna. He printed it out and studied it. He drew a star in red pen over the coffee table section, in between the antique bicycles and the seedlings. "A labyrinth is different from a maze," he said, handing the page to Joanna as she handed him a bowl of popcorn. "A maze has branches, choices about which direction you should go. You could end up in a dead end, but a labyrinth is different. Even though it takes twists and turns, there's always only one way to go, and if you just keep walking, you'll end up at the end." Unicursal, he called it. If they just kept walking, they would get through. They knew exactly what they wanted. They knew exactly how to get there, they would stay focused, and they would be in and out and unscathed. The wide cylindrical tower of the labyrinth rose from the parking lot. The tower was dark stone, so bleak it seemed to suck the light from the sky. The parking lot was asphalt and fading white paint. The heat bounced up from the ground, and Joanna fanned her armpits as she got out of the car, and immediately started to sweat despite her tank top. Reaching into the back seat, she grabbed the sweatshirt she'd been advised to bring. Tony squeezed her arm, his other hand adjusting the strap of his backpack, crammed with water and protein bars and trail mix. His hand was too warm on her bare shoulder. Together, they headed for the entrance. The trail through the labyrinth started with dining chairs. Chairs stacked on chairs, chairs stored upside down, chairs without partners or sets. There were chairs from every age, as if portals had opened in ancient Greece, Ming-era China, 1920s Baltimore. Portals had opened and sucked up single chairs, depositing them here, unloved and out of place, in the labyrinth. Chairs in unforgiving iron and chairs with legs bulging and swirling with carved foliage. Upholstered chairs with gold embroidery of birds, and chairs with high backs like thrones to preside over dinner. All terrifying and extravagant. Joanna shrugged into her sweatshirt and took Tony's hand. They kept walking, looking straight forward, not to be distracted. "In and out," he said under his breath. "In and out," she agreed. They passed rugs of every shape and color, hanging from racks to either side of the path. They looked like a great bookshelf of unmarked spines. They passed the actual books, Shelves and shelves and shelves, all archaic or occult, mostly written in rhyme or dead languages or both. They passed the armoires, each of which looked to be a doorway to another realm or a place to hide a skeleton. They passed tile, outdoor, and musical instruments, woodwinds, and every color of paint and sofas where Joanna imagined herself being fed grapes. Each section was a mess of clutter, an oppressive squeeze of artifacts, ancient and modern and dated. But the path on the whole was organized. All the curtains here, all the light fixtures there, all the shoes in the next section. No one knew where the stuff came from. Did each chair appear magically, spirited away from a furniture store in New Mexico or a museum in Iran? Were there elves unseen below the labyrinth, constantly replenishing the stock? Was this the afterlife of destroyed furniture, of beds rotted away in landfills, reappearing here as a ghost bed and no one could tell the difference? No one knew, or if anyone knew, they weren't sharing. Every piece was unique. When someone bought an item, something new appeared. Sometimes new things appeared not to replace something, but to add to the ever-building hoard. An army of volunteers, of people who had fallen so in love with the bizarre magic of the labyrinth that they gave up their time and energy, coded up a database, and tracked the comings and goings of the items. The labyrinth did have staff. At least, everyone assumed they were staff. They were muscly men with bright yellow aprons, hooved feet, and the horns and shaggy-maned heads of bulls. Perhaps they knew the answer to the labyrinth's mysteries, but as they themselves were mysteries, they weren't sharing. They worked in an unending battle to sort the stuff that arrived and keep the labyrinth as neat as they could. Their goal was for people to remove the items so the stone walls of the labyrinth would not crack open like an egg, like a volcano, spilling home goods out across the parking lot. Each item in the labyrinth was $5. If Tony and Joanna kept walking, if they kept focused, they would come out the other side with a $5 coffee table. They were 5 minutes on the path. 10, 20, 40. The faces of the people around them pinched together in anxiety and fatigue. The outdoor bench section was filled with sitting couples, rubbing their thighs, drinking water. A woman sat on a glider near the path, her face red despite the cold. She wiped her neck with the hem of her cardigan. Her husband stood before her, pulling away from her like a dog on a leash who smelled a squirrel. "We're almost there," he complained, and she snapped, "I just need a minute." "You've already had 5 minutes. I don't want to be here all day." Tony and Joanna exchanged a look once they passed. What a thing. Why do people have such trouble doing simple things together? Tony and Joanna couldn't possibly be the only couple on Earth sure enough to walk the labyrinth. What was wrong with these people? The next fight they witnessed was an argument about bath mats. It wasn't an out-and-out fight. The couple was disagreeing in reasonable tones. But in the time it took to pass them, the one guy argued that the bathroom was already dark and a navy blue bath mat would just make it worse. And the second guy argued that it was dark because the light bulb was super yellow, and maybe a blue mat would make it seem less so. And the first guy shook his head and said it would make the space darker, and the second guy gesticulated, as if he could convey color theory with his hands. "The light in there is yellow!" The next fight was in the sink faucets section, but they passed through too late in the fight to know how the argument had grown from picking faucets. The couple weren't even facing the faucets, now just standing before them, a non sequitur setting to their drama. It was not about faucets anymore. Now it was about his mother moving in with them. "You've always hated my mother." "She's always hated me. She's always hated you. Don't you see how she treats you?" "Don't talk about my mother that way." Tony made a yikes face, and together they ducked out of the way of a family, pushing a cart opposite the direction of traffic. They were still less than halfway through, so it was faster to turn around than follow the path to its end. The cart lugged a pair of 3-foot-tall speakers. The man pushing the cart did not argue with his tired wife and 2 tired kids, but he was breathing as if he might not have air to argue if he wanted to. He grit his teeth and pushed the cart towards the exit, just wanting to get out. Tony wanted to panic. Everyone else was panicking, so maybe they had a point. Maybe they knew something he didn't. It would be so easy to relax into the anxiety. What if the table was gone? What if they couldn't carry it out? Should they have brought a cart? What if they started fighting? He pictured himself shouting at her that she never cleaned the bathroom, and her shouting at him that she was too tired to clean the bathroom, and if he cared about it so much, he could do it himself. He'd shout that she was the one who cared about cleanliness, and she was always on his case for him to dress better, and then she'd give him the same old speech about how he should dress for the job he wanted, and maybe if he put some effort into it, he too could get a full-time, high-paying, soul-sucking job, and then they'd both be too tired to clean the bathroom. She squeezed his hand. You all right? You look upset. There was fear in her eyes. He forced his pulse back to normal and smiled at her. Let's take a break. They stopped in outdoor fireplaces and set up on a circular bench surrounding a fire pit. He handed her a water bottle, which she opened but didn't drink from, too busy checking the map, marking their progress with her eyes, calculating how much longer they would have to stay. He took a drink of his own water, which cramped his chest, it was so cold. He told himself that the chill was washing away his insecurities, reminding him that they were solid, and a trek through the labyrinth wouldn't bring them low. They were too strong for that, too in love. She popped the hoodie string on her sweatshirt into her mouth, chewing on the aglet as she thought. He grinned and grabbed the other end of the string, poking it into the other side of her mouth, causing her to yelp and slap his hands away from her face. Three more sections, she said. In and out. They passed the seedlings and came to the coffee tables. The relief that rolled through their shoulders slowly rebuilt over the next few minutes as they circled the section, squeezing between tables, trying to find the one they picked out. And they couldn't find it. And they couldn't find it. Do you think someone's taken it? Since last night? Maybe. They both got out their phones to check the database, both lifting their phones into the air to try for a better signal, a faster speed. I think it's this one. That doesn't look right. It doesn't look right, but I think it is. Let's keep looking. Maybe it's over there. No, look, the call numbers match. The call numbers did match. They stared at the table, which was far lower than the picture made it look. The tabletop almost reached her knees. The inlaid tile looked less rustic Italian and more craft fair. They stared at it. And they stared at it. It dawned on them that this was not the perfect table. It dawned on them that they would have to pick another one. It dawned on them that their well-laid plans had collapsed, leaving them unmoored, sinking, drowning. "We have to find a different table," he said. Her heart contracted too fast, squeezed so tight it missed the next beat. By unspoken agreement, they separated, searching the tables alone. Surely there was something here she would like. But she was too startled to focus her eyes. Her fingers dragged over glass and wood and plastic as she wondered. Maybe she would know the right table when she touched it. Surely he'd find something that worked. He knelt down by anything that caught his eye, inspecting the joints underneath, as if he knew good craftsmanship when he saw it. He no longer knew what he was looking for. "What about this one?" she called, and he stopped his search to return to her. The tabletop was white stone with a shine, like fake marble. Or real marble. "That's way too fancy," he said. "What? It's not that fancy." "Not like opulent fancy," he said. "Like modernist fancy. Like we're going to have bright white walls and no books on the shelves, never have anything out." "Never have anything out? You mean like if we cleaned up after ourselves?" "I mean I want our house to look lived in." "Like your college dorm looked lived in, and the last two apartments looked lived in? With the posters taped to the wall and the coffee table made out of a milk crate?" He took a deep breath and stayed calm, even as the walls closed in, anxiety oozing from the stone, releasing into the air to poison everyone inside. "I want it to be comfortable. This doesn't look comfortable." "Did you find something that's more comfortable?" He led her over to a simple one. Round and wide and made out of wood with a geometric pattern in it. "That one's too big to fit in front of the sofa." "But we're going to have to move things around, right? If we get a round table that's small enough to fit in front of the sofa now, it wouldn't be big enough to be worth it." "We don't have to get a round table." "I'd like a round table." "But it doesn't fit." "But it doesn't have the sharp corners like the one you picked." "Oh, do you think you'd hurt yourself on a sharp corner?" I'd be worried that it wouldn't be good for a baby. It was a struggle to plunge through the sudden lightheadedness that hit her, so she put effort into keeping her wits about her, but she felt as if the floor of the labyrinth had buckled under her feet. "Who said anything about a baby?" Her voice came out higher than she'd expected, and climbed higher still. "Since when do you want a baby? You want a baby in the condo we don't keep clean and has a milk crate for a coffee table? No, we're getting a real coffee table." "Excuse me." They both spun to face the interruption. They had both forgotten where they were, so the confronting reminder in the form of a hulking minotaur, biceps barely held in by a straining t-shirt, horns darkened as if streaked with coal, hit them just as solidly as the admission in their fight. Joanna's mouth fell open in surprise, her back jerking ramrod straight. Tony startled and yelped, grabbing Joanna's arm to pull her back before he stopped himself. The minotaur showed no offense at their behavior, and tilted his head with what might be a smile and what might be a predatory gaze. They reeled at the sight, so unnatural, so much like the labyrinth that had corrupted them. "Are you finding everything okay?"
We had a coffee table picked out, but it wasn't what we expected, and now we don't know."
They trailed off. The minotaur nodded, sympathetic. His nostrils flared with a loud, hot breath. "What are you looking for?"
Round corners? Clean lines? Warm wood would be nice."
The minotaur nodded again, his attention drifting, and one ear ticking as if he'd forgotten they existed, as if he'd been distracted by a fly. He set off across the section, and Joanna and Tony looked at each other, unsure if they should follow, before scurrying after their guide. The minotaur came to a stop before a table. "What about this one?" "Rounded corners, clean lines, a wood top. It was not awkwardly large and would probably fit." They nodded too enthusiastically, their minds fighting against their bodies to stay rooted to the ground instead of running, to be polite instead of grabbing the nearest object and attacking with it.
"Yes, yes, that looks good. Perfect. We'll take it."
The minotaur loomed 2 feet taller than Tony, as he took a stubbly pencil from his yellow apron pocket and with thick fingers wrote the coffee table's call number on a slip of paper. He handed it out for Joanna, and she snatched it away. She didn't let their fingers brush, but her spine erupted in shivers anyway.
"So you can keep track of it while you browse," the minotaur said.
Then maybe he smiled again and wandered off. His shoulders rolled with every clip-clopping step. Joanna was lightheaded again. Tony's heart had never beaten so fast.
"We're taking this one," she said.
"In and out," he agreed. They carried the table between them. They stuck to the path, not to be distracted by the offerings around them. They did not fight again. They did not speak even to complain about the weight, or the distance, or the jostling of other families. In the silence between them, they both separately came to the same conclusion. They were doing okay. Their problems weren't that bad, and they were great at dealing with them. Their love would endure, because it was stronger than other love. They had conquered the labyrinth. The 20% True podcast was written and produced by me, Carolyn Rahaman. Music was composed by Kamiku. If you like the show, please be sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts so other people can discover it. Follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/20percenttrue. Visit my website, 20percenttrue.blogspot.com, for updates, thoughts on writing, and book reviews. And follow me on Twitter at Carrie and the Hits.